Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. From about 10:30 until noon yesterday, it felt like a combination of Lemony Snicket's series of unfortunate events mixed with Mr. Toad's wild ride. I came out of it safely and with a guest for the next half hour whose veracity I'm still trying to determine, but this might be just the place for this WDEV listener to share his story, and it's a wild one. Here's what happened. I promised you Senator Randy Brock yesterday at 10:30 to discuss his thoughts on the state's broadband rollout. Unfortunately, Senator Brock was in a committee meeting and had me penciled in for next Monday. That happens to all of us. So I opened up the phones with no real theme or question in mind. Reliable Fred from Newbury came and called in with his thoughts about the District of Columbia becoming the 51st state. In response, I gave Fred the task of designing the new 51-star United States flag. He spit the bait. Following the show, though, I did hear from several listeners. First of all, a dairy farmer from Craftsbury called to explain where he thought Randy Brock was, an ag oversight meeting, and we got to talking about the state of dairy farming in Vermont. Let's just say you better really, really love dairy farming to be a dairy farmer these days. Let me also say that if you're a farmer and would care to be a guest on this show to talk about farming and the current situation, please feel free to email me at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Your thoughts on ag in the state is worth my time and our listeners' time to hear what you have to say. Going to farmers markets or farm stands might be only half the equation of how we support our farmers. I then got an email from Senator Brock apologizing for his scheduling error. Next was an email from Rich from Starksboro. His flag design had 6 rows, and the rows alternated between 8 and 9 stars, totaling 51. Then John Willis McNulty sent his flag design. I couldn't believe it became a thing all of a sudden. He had 9 rows alternating between 7 and 4 stars, with the top and bottom rows with 7 stars, also reaching 51. McNulty also included a note that said he was an extremely fascinating narcissist, a narcissistic raconteur, and wondered if I'd like to interview him. We spoke. He made some incredible claims, few of which I believe anyone will ever be able to accurately fact check, but I took the bait. Ladies and gentlemen, our first guest of the day, John Willis McNulty. John, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to your audience. I'm not sure that I'm ready for your audience or your audience is ready for me, but here it goes. You know, I love your show. It's great to hear your voice back in Vermont. I was driving through New Hampshire and I thought I was in a time warp at some point. I thought I was back in Vermont while I was driving through Claremont. I guess you had a hiatus out of the state in the Granite State.
I actually didn't leave the state.
You didn't leave?
No, I was in lockdown. I was in Vermont.
You have my sympathy.
All right. So, listeners, if you'd like to ask a question or share a comment about what you're about to hear, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I've been in Vermont since 03, 18 years. Oh, coming up the end of the month. May 29th will be my anniversary, John. And I am hopefully staying here for as long as I possibly can till they march me to the border and say, get out. All right.
So, yeah, they haven't, someone told me they were going to have to come up here and put a fry bar underneath my butt to get me out of here. I've been here for 35 years. I'm a denizen of the Green Mountain State. I originally hail from the Bay State.
Oh. So you're a flatlander just like me.
I just want to open with an anecdote because they sure. Tell you you're supposed to do that in Toastmasters Club. So
right,
I had a friend from that owned an air conditioning business down in Newton, Massachusetts. a guy named Bill, who's long been deceased. He had a beach bonanza. And we were down at Middlebury Airport, and I'm sitting in the co-pilot seat. Never sat in the co-pilot seat in my entire life. I've got the headphones on. He's got the headphones on. And, you know, it's an unmuffled piston engine, and it's louder than heck, and you got the headphones on, and that's the only way you can hear each other. And you got to yell into the mic He said, "Are you nervous?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Is this your first time?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You've never been nervous before?" So, yes, I've been nervous. The first time I spoke at town meeting, my voice cracked and went into a falsetto. I have terrible stage fright.
Well, you're doing all right so far.
I hail from the Bay State. I was born in Methuen, Massachusetts, which was also the birthplace of Roger, who was the founder of guerrilla combat, the founder of the Rangers, the Army Rangers. Parenthetically, my brother was an Army Ranger, was in the 717th Cavalry, participated in the Cambodian invasion, and was one of the most highly decorated men to serve in the conflict. And I give a shout out to all the veterans in the audience here.
Absolutely, we can't thank them enough.
My brother's memory. Sorry to take that brief. Actually, that's kind of like a lachrymose, morose sort of note to kind of introduce my family.
All right.
My mom and my dad, and this is kind of crucial to the whole thing, because my mom and my dad met at a place called Penny Camp outside Dayton, Ohio.
Where I went to college.
I should know my story better. Is that National Cash Register, or is that Burroughs?
It's National Cash Register.
National Cash Register. So Penny Camp was the place where they were building the training people to use the machine, the NCR computer that they were building to use at Gallaudet University to break the J code.
Mm.
That's where my mother met my father. My father was lecturing at BC and actively avoiding the draft in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
They came and made him an offer he couldn't refuse, which was either to actually go fight or put on a Naval Reserve uniform and go do this work for Naval Intelligence. So he, being a pacifist and a coward, he decided to go work at Gallaudet.
All right.
The history is that they broke the J code, they broke the J code just prior to the Battle of Midway, and it was a decisive battle in the naval history of the conflict in the Pacific, and it turned the tide of the war, which all of my father's compatriots were overjoyed with. My father was mortified with the notion that he participated in killing so many people.
Yeah.
My mother told me the story on her deathbed. He went AWOL. He was discovered a month later down in Miami. He didn't know his name. When they brought him back and they put him in a psych ward. And he couldn't stop crying. He eventually got over whatever was bugging him. But he was given a medical discharge from the Navy during World War II. Having never raised a fist in anger against anyone, and being morally mortified that he actually helped in some way.
Yeah.
So that was my dad. He was also an alcoholic.
Well, let me ask a little about yourself.
It's kind of crucial because, you know, alcoholism is, you know, it's not necessarily hereditary, but it, you know, it helps out parents that are alcoholics. I'm also an alcoholic. I started drinking at an early age. my father was, by the time I was 15, my father had the radish. I mean, he actually died at his own hand, but he would have died some other way. He was a late stage alcoholic. He was very bad off, could not work, basically couldn't function. So, you know, after that, I ended up at this, because, you know, I just ended up with a bunch of behavioral problems because of all that. And my mother just kind of, did a drop kick me through the goalpost of life, sweet Jesus, with me and heard about the school up in Maine called Hyde. And I'd like to give a shout out to, I believe Greg Hooker played a Hyde alum yesterday, John Hyatt's daughter. Both of John Hyatt's daughters went to, Hyde. Michael McDonald's kids went to Hyde. I believe there's some famous Hyde alum out there in the Mad River Valley. Shout out to
good music lineage, which is a good music lineage, which is a kind of a foreshadowing for what's to come. After you left Hyde, where'd you go to college?
I went to Salem State and I dropped out. And you know, I ended up hanging around with the, you know, tried to start a band. So as you might guess, Hyde had a large performing art component, and you know, they had a touring show. I had the lead guitar seat. I was fairly talented. I actually wrote some original material for the show that was performed. You know, I kind of bummed around Salem for a while, and then, you know, I ended up moving to Boston. I was trying to figure out what to do in terms of, you know, making money, and I became a self-taught engineer. Mm-hmm. At that point, if you knew how to wire together, CMOS and TTL circuits and how to bias a FET and a bipolar transistor and program a microprocessor, it didn't matter what kind of degree you had, you got a job. I just have people cold called me. So just to give you an example of what my career was like in Massachusetts.
Now, John, we really got to get some giddy up here. I'm going to try to run through your – that's all right. No, I'm going to try to run through your career.
There's a lot of exposition, and I love to digress. And I realized I was taking notes and preparing for this, and I didn't do the one thing that I meant to do, which was – have a clock and watch it.
Now, JWN, you got a big story. You got a big story. We're going to try to move through it as quickly as possible from this point forward. So, first of all, you had a role in beating a chess master.
I went through a bunch of this stuff, and you know, in terms of my technical career, I worked at IBM and I worked on, I was like telling you this stuff so you'd realize that I was a legitimate person and that I wasn't just some random crank.
I'm a very specific crank.
I worked on the chipset that went into Deep Blue, which was the first demonstration of artificial intelligence that beat Kasparov at chess. My favorite technical accomplishment, aside from being the prototype of the Jumbotron, being in the room when the first dual core microprocessor booted. And the first dual core microprocessor in the world that actually worked booted a Linux kernel. So shout out to open source software. but anyway, to cut to the chase. I was trying to lay the table that I had a lot of mental health things going on back in the day, and so you know, I was trying to lay the table to where I'm in the Orpheum Theater on July 25th, 1980, and I'm having a really good time. The Jerry Garcia Band went through the first set, and it was a really great first set. And actually, back in the day, it was like you had to buy a ticket for the first set and ticket for the second set. And so, you know, I came back in for the second show, and I saw this girl that I was just like completely infatuated with from Hyde School. This is why Hyde figures into this. Mm-hmm. And she was with, you know, I was like, you know, I was just like gaga over this. I mean, like just nuts over this girl, and was just heartbroken that she jilted me. And I saw her, I was like, hey, Molly, how you doing? Hey, and she's like, get them away from me.
All right.
Yeah.
It's
and
a family
then her
show.
Boyfriend came up and started sticking his finger into my chest, going, bah, 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 bah. And then he cranks back, and he slugs me and lays me down. And then all of her friends are, like, standing over me. I'm laying down on the floor in the Orpheum, and they're all laughing at me. And I was like, oh, my God. I couldn't believe what was going on. I just felt, like, completely dejected. And to top that off, I mean, the girl that I was living with, the woman that I was living with at the time left me for another woman. So, you know, I was feeling, because I had, like, two tickets to both of these shows, and there was an empty seat next to me, right? So I went back into the second show, and I was, like, completely, I mean, like the nadir of my emotional life up to that point, my tender young existence. And, you know, and I'm just, like, looking at Jerry play and just, it's like I felt like I had a Vulcan mind meld with him. And he was, like, I just had this feeling from him that like he understood what I was going through emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like he spoke to me directly. I felt like he said to me, go write a song about this. Take this pain and turn it into a song.
All right.
And I was actually writing songs. I had several active titles going on at the time. And I had one that was kind of inspired by the fact that that Jerry's hair was noticeably beginning to go gray.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a disassociative fugue at this point. I was actually using the name Peyton Farquhar. I jumped into a cab. You know, it kind of, you know, like if you go through it, it's like, this is like a major mental health event for me. But I mean, like if you kind of read through it, it kind of reads like, you know, like the Blues Brothers. So I jumped into this cab on Tremont Street, and it ended up being a dead end. And I was like, I jumped in, I said, take me to wherever Robert Hunter is. And he was like, dude, how do I know where Robert Hunter is? I said, you're a cabbie in all the film noirs. You know, cabbies always know where to go, and you're a deadhead. Find me Robert Hunter. Because I heard Robert Hunter was at a party, and he gets on his radio, and he asks his dispatcher about traffic from the Orpheum Theater, and gets an address. We go up to this place in Brighton, and lo and behold, it's a place that I know, and I know some of the guys that live there. And it's like a notorious after hours place, it's like a protected after hours place.
Now, John, I'm just going to cut you off for a second. We have less than four minutes to let people know your connection to Touch of Grey and Run for the Roses and Silvio. So you might want to fast forward as quickly as you can.
Quickly as I can. Yeah. So, get to the punchline. So
yeah, that would be it.
So Warren and I ended up in this after hours place. And so the first line of Touch of Grey is actually misheard, because what I said to Robert Hunter was it must be getting early, the cops are running late, because there used to be a bad guy from the Brighton police that used to pick up a bag of money, because the place was like a party place. It was protected by Whitey Bulger. The clocks are running late. The daylight in the morning sky looks like abalone, and he looked at me, looked like cross-eyed. He's like, really, abalone? I said, looks so phony. And he said, yeah, it looks so phony. And then I said, how about the daylight in the paint-by-number sky looks so phony, like that. And then, you know, I had drawn the curtains, and, you know, I had a disassociative identity disorder, and I saw the morning light, and I said, you know, I'm basically Mr. Jekyll and Dr. Hyde here, and I'm it's daylight and I'm leaving. And he asked me if I wanted anything for the song, and I said no. I asked him if, you know, he asked me if I wanted any money for it, and I said no.
So this was Robert Hunter who wrote the song.
What I'd like you to do is base the intro on Bertha.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I woke up the next morning and had no idea about any of this. And actually, just recently started remembering this. I started remembering this. It was Robert Hunter's death that spurred me to start remembering all this stuff. I've been haunted by it all my life. Well, most of my life, most of my adult life, by Touch of Grey. And yeah, so, and we also went through another title that that I had working, which was Fun for the Roses, which is a far superior song, which is mostly Robert Hunter. I mean, I think the ears of Robert Hunter would be relieved to know that most of Touch of Grey was not Robert Hunter. I honestly really don't think it's a good song. The song I really like is Silvio. Silvio was a song I started writing in 79 after a Grateful Dead concert. I was standing underneath the underpass of I-90 hitchhiking back to Boston. There was a longtime representative, Silvio Conti, who was running for re-election, the Silvio Conti Natural Wildlife area in Vermont.
That's right.
And we started playing, me and my girlfriend started playing with Silvio. We were singing the song Silvio, Silver and Gold. And so I was working on that. I was singing that in Winthrop Park one day, and this guy came up and asked me about it, and I told him, he said he wanted to sing it, and I said, it was the guy that talked to me in the park wasn't Bob Dylan. And I basically told him to, you know, go take a bath, and I'd see him later. And, you know, I grabbed my guitar and packed my guitar up, and I went down to a place called Charlie's Kitchen on Elliott Street.
John,
yep.
We're out of time.
Damn.
But what we've ascertained is that you worked on Deep Blue, the original Jumbotron, the Space Shuttle, and you've written, with the help of Robert Hunter, Touch of Grey, Run for the Roses, and Bob Dylan's song Silvio. So we'll leave it there. And
Thank you.
I don't know how anyone will ever fact check it, but if anyone's listening who wants to write a very interesting biography, they can contact me, and I will put you in touch with John Willis McNulty, who I thank you for sharing what might or might not be your imprint on the history of American music. Thanks, John.
Thank you. Thank you,
Bert. Take care. We're going to take a break, and we're going to take a CBS News update break. And while we return, we're going to discuss the role of Vermont's senior centers played in supporting older Vermonters during the pandemic. And a reminder that the Sox back in action tonight against the Detroit Tigers from Fenway. Coverage begins at 6:10, first pitch at 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th, time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. May is Older Americans Month, and this year's theme is Communities of Strength. Vermont senior centers have played a vital role in supporting older Vermonters throughout the pandemic and will be key to recovery and reconnection for many of our seniors post-pandemic. Today, we're joined by director of the Vermont State Unit on Aging, Connor O'Day. He's here to talk about senior centers, their importance, their experiences during and after the pandemic, and finding a way forward. And Connor, I want to welcome you to Vermont Viewpoint.
Rick, thanks so much for having me today.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got a question for Connor, or if you'd like to share how you've seen senior centers help our older Vermonters, you can give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. When I hear that term, Connor, senior center, I kind of conjure up a specific image or thought, but how do you describe a senior center?
Yeah, simply put, I would describe it as that community focal point for older adults, kind of that gateway into what's available in the community for seniors. And really what the groundwork of it is it's built around sharing a meal together, that congregate meal. But then it's so much more, right? It's activities for seniors, it's health, it's information that they can get there, it's social connections. So really, really driven by those who are participating in the center and those who work there and creating connections.
And Connor, do we have them in all of our communities throughout the state, or how prevalent are they?
So they're not going to be located in every community, but they're located throughout each of our counties for sure. And so What folks can do is either if they have access to online, you know, Google their local community center, or they can get in touch with their local area agency on aging and find out where the nearest center is and how to get connected.
And then who runs these centers?
So it's often run by, it could be a variety. It could be the town who runs it. It could be a grassroots organization that runs it. And mostly there's a mix of paid staff, but I would say the most important part to our senior centers are those who volunteer. It's really driven a lot by people putting in their volunteer time and making it happen in terms of getting these meals put together, putting together the services, finding the funding sources to support them.
How are they funded?
A variety.
Yeah. How are they funded,
Connor? Yeah, so it's interesting. It's really a mix. So there's federal funds, there's state funds, there might be funds that come through the town, and then there's, again, driven through that volunteer and that private donation support is a big part of it. So on the national level, just to give you a sense, it's reported that senior centers usually have 3 to 8 different funding sources.
Wow. Now, you mentioned that they might not be in every community, you know, more likely, you know, they'd be one or, you know, in a county. So what kind of transportation services are provided for those using these senior centers?
Yeah, so in some cases we have senior centers that offer up transportation. They might have a van that they've purchased and are able to provide that for individuals in their area. But then also we have our supported public transit, which is a door-to-door service that folks can connect with. And again, I would recommend through their local area agency on aging. That's the simplest one-door stop to kind of get an understanding of what transportation and what public transit is available in their area and getting signed up.
How great is the need for these centers in Vermont?
I would say it can't be overstated. You know, when you think about what they can offer in terms of creating connections for people, creating a social environment, and really being an efficient way to offer up a variety of services and get to people, I think the need just, again, it can't be overstated because, you know, their target population for those older adults is very important. But then again, you know, they're a very efficient model to be able to operate a variety of programs at a cost-effective way and reach a large group of people. So, yeah, I see them as a very, very important need for our communities.
And, Connor, I'd like to get an idea of who uses the senior centers. So, first of all, how old are the participants who come there?
Again, on average, the national, it's reported about 75 years of age, but I think when people start to think about a senior center, you're really getting into that 60 and over population. And it's a mixed group of people. It tends to be, if you're looking at the national numbers, predominant more women than men. Tend to see folks who might live alone or are looking for a social interaction group setting. And people who also are looking for connection in other ways. So if they're wanting to create or participate in, say, a Tai Chi class or a program that's called Matter of Balance, an exercise class to improve strength, and it, you know, a senior center is a great option. So people, I think, who generally are looking for activities and to connect with others.
You mentioned that balance program, vitally important, isn't it? Because falls for seniors tend to be somewhat prevalent and can be seriously debilitating.
Yeah, when you look at the research, you know, falls can be often the first thing that lead to then compounding reoccurring issues. So really trying to prevent those falls, and be thinking about, you know, maintaining that balance, maintaining that strength, and, you know, just absolutely, I think, critical towards healthy aging and being able to maintain that freedom and independence that people want.
Are there other ways that the senior centers help their constituency live a healthier lifestyle?
Certainly. Yeah, I think, you know, again, the social connection can never be understated in terms of how important that is to just general well-being and happiness. But then when you look at what they offer, everything from they do foot clinics, they do, you know, nutrition counseling at the senior centers. They do wellness checks at some of our senior centers. And really, they can make connections to other community resources. So, again, you might go into a senior center thinking that you're going in for one thing or one specific focus and then find, oh, wow, they've got this or they've got that. So, again, it's a really a great gateway for healthy aging, healthy living.
Now, Connor O'Day, your area is within the Department of Disabilities, Aging, and Independent Living, or known as DALE. So what is the mission of your department in regard to these centers?
Really, yeah, we just want to make sure that people can age to the best of their abilities, living in their communities, and remain active and engaged. So it's really, you know, the senior centers play a critical part in our mission because they are that focal point that can really connect people into other services or just other community-oriented activities and really help people maintain their independence.
And are there other programs that DALE oversees?
Yes, a variety of programs really around, again, maintaining that independence, that active living, allowing people to live to the best of their abilities and the life that they want to. So that could be around people seeking employment, assistance there, people seeking transportation, access into their community, assistance in the home. So if you're looking for any of what gets often referred to as homemaker services, that light chore, access to that, personal care assistance. So really a wide variety in terms of services.
Connor, what has changed about the ways that the senior centers have operated during the pandemic?
Yeah, most noticeably is that having to, not being able to do congregate meals. So they've really had to position themselves and did so very quickly and really effectively to curbside pickup meals and then delivery. And again, you know, just highlighting how successful they were with that and doing it very quickly and effectively and making sure that there wasn't any disruption to people who were needing those meal services. And then, you know, I spoke earlier to all the plethora of activities that they offer, and they really had to figure out how to transition those to online, web-based, and be able to offer up their services in a different kind of way than what they were used to.
Well, as you mentioned, a lot of these things online. So was it a challenge for these seniors to use the technology required to connect during COVID?
You know, it's been really, really encouraging in terms of what senior centers have been learning and how receptive the older adults have been to technology. And once they got through some of the hiccups of connectivity and which platforms to use and getting comfortable with those platforms.
Which confused all of us.
Exactly. We've all been there.
Right.
And so not unique by any means.
Yep.
And really quite successful, seeing higher rates of participation and people, I think, just really appreciating having at least something to be able to connect. And, you know, not everything's the high tech either, not to just focus on, you know, Zoom or Teams or something like that. Also, you know, getting back to how much it means to people to connect over the phone and to set up a system where you're checking in on folks, you're seeing how everything's going, and you're just getting this nice interaction. So it was almost like a step back to say, you know, we can do things a different way, and it's okay, and it does work well.
That's a great point. Where are we now? How are things changing back yet?
Things are starting to change back, yes. We're seeing we have in Heimberg, we have their senior center open. And then for most others, they're going to be doing soft openings in May, which will be some limited group activities, getting to setting up, you know, as we get into this warmer weather, putting up their tents, doing outdoor, and then really trying to align with that Vermont Forward plan. So, you know, that July 4th date is the marker that people are really excited for and have their eyes on and are hoping that, you know, our vaccination numbers hit what they need to so they can really get back into fully operating.
Wow, that's just 2 months from today. How exciting. Let's take a call now from Stephen, who joins us from Montpelier. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Rick. I have a comment or a question and a comment.
Okay.
I'm wondering whether senior centers allow animals like dogs.
All right. Connor?
That's a great question, Stephen. And honestly, I'm sorry. I would have to defer and have to connect with the senior center if they do have any policy around animals. My gut feeling is that it might depend site to site on what their policy is around that, but we can certainly find out for you.
All right. And Stephen, you said you had a comment as well. Yep.
Yes. Yesterday I gave blood at the Montpelier City Hall, and I was speaking with the person who was doing the blood drawing, and she mentioned that they actually collect blood from dogs. And the reason for that is they have a dog blood bank so that when dogs have operations, they have, you know, and they lose blood, they can go to a blood bank and get the blood they need during the operations. And I just never had thought about that.
Wow. Stephen, thanks for the call. Connor, I'm gobsmacked. I've never heard that before. Have you ever heard of a blood bank for animals?
Rick, I have not. No.
It makes total sense.
Stephen, thanks so much.
And it's a little bit far afield from what we're talking about today, but I'm going to try to get somebody from an animal blood bank on the show because I find that absolutely fascinating. Stephen, thanks for that comment, and we'll see what we can find out about that. Now, I want to hop back to where we were. This is Older Americans Month. And the theme this year, Connor, is communities of strength, which seems appropriate following the pandemic. So what kept seniors strong when they were unable to socialize and take part in the kinds of activities that we've been talking about at senior centers?
That's a great question, and one we're really trying to pinpoint on because they've shown amazing resilience, and there's a lot of, I think, folks looking at just what experience allows people in terms of having that resilience, having that strength, having that, maybe that perspective and that larger view of what's important. And so seniors, you know, have done extremely well during this time in terms of dealing with some of the loneliness or the not being able to connect. And again, just very, very resilient, very strong.
And I mentioned Dale is the Disabilities, Aging, and Independent Living Department. How will Dale help seniors move past this pandemic?
Yeah, so I think it's really important that our policies reflect what we've learned has done very well during the pandemic. And so, you know, really promoting and making sure that we are connected via telehealth and utilizing technology to make things more efficient. And then in terms of preparedness, so now that we know what can happen during something like this and what it can do to our systems, how to really make sure that our systems are strong and can be ready for what may be the next thing. Fingers crossed we won't have that, but we really need to take the lessons that we've learned of what has worked well, what has not worked well, and apply that for the future.
Are there any additional programs that we're not offering right now or might not be offered in many places that you'd like to see be added for our seniors?
So it's not necessarily so much new services, but I think one of the things that's going to be really fun to follow and see how it progresses is this concept of services without walls. And so take the concept of your senior centers. I think in speaking with senior center directors and hearing about the successes of running online programming, it's got them kind of clued into this notion that we can run hybrid models and that we can connect with more people in an effective way. And so I think we're going to see more of that in the future. And that could be applied to adult day centers, senior centers, and I think other programs. And so I think that's really exciting and something to really keep our eyes on.
Services without walls, we will keep an eye on that. Sounds like, you know, something, yeah, the pandemic certainly has forced our hand in a lot of areas. And as you say, we can learn from this and the successes of what we've done during the last year plus and see where we take it from there. What about those of us, the rest of us, what can we all do to help our seniors?
Yeah, I think it's oftentimes just really small things that can be the most meaningful and the impactful of noticing your neighbors, noticing, you know, even how you get the word out about things or how you might advertise things and think about, is this going to connect to seniors who are such a large part of our community and are the makeup of Vermont, and we want to make sure that they are involved in our public processes, that they're involved in our social happenings and engaged, because, again, how much they offer and what they can bring to the table. So I think, you know, the more intentional we can be about how we think about design or how we think about how we get word about things, to be mindful of our older population and make sure that we're more inclusive.
Connor, we have just a minute left, but early in this conversation, you mentioned you gave a shout-out to volunteers for these senior centers. How great is the need for volunteers, and what kind of roles do they play in these senior centers?
The need is always there. So, yeah, if you're thinking about volunteering or you've got the bug for it, please consider volunteering your senior centers. That's meal delivery, meal prep, that could be running an exercise class, that could be just probably, you know, being utilized in terms of assistance just in the operations of the building, cleanup and setting things up and, you know, all of the logistics that go into making these programs happen. So, you know, there's all sorts of opportunities to get involved and to contribute.
Connor O'Day is the director of the Vermont State Unit on Aging. And, Connor, it was a pleasure having you on the program this morning. Thanks so much.
Rick, thank you.
You're welcome. We're going to break now for CBS News, and then we'll be back to talk to the folks running Vermont's Rootstock Publishing. And a reminder, it's Tuesday. That means just after 11. We'll be going to the Governor's COVID-19 Response News Conference until 12:30. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th, time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Getting a book published is not a simple matter, though more avenues exist now for authors than did in the past. There are the big five publishers. They're the major houses whose traditional approach offers the dream contract. But the big five don't accept unagented submissions, and your chances of getting an offer are generally considered very slim, even if you succeed in the almost equally difficult task of finding an agent. Self-publishing might be an option, but only if you have the knowledge to navigate that on your own. And enter the hybrid press. One of these is based here in Vermont, Rootstock Publishing. Joining me now is Stephen MacArthur. He's one of the founders and publishers of Rootstock. Stephen, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. We also have Rootstock's poetry series editor and marketing director, Samantha Kolber. Samantha, thank you for being here as well.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for having me, too.
You're welcome. Listeners, to ask our guests about the world of publishing, you can give us a call, 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255, or feel free to email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Stephen, give us a little history of Rootstock Publishing.
Sure. I've been in the music business for many, many years, decades, actually. And as the music business, CDs and DVDs began to disappear in terms of a really good market, and everything went digital, we modified everything, and we are now all completely digital with our music business, which is part of what's called multicultural media. Mm-hmm. But it didn't require a lot of work to just have all our music sitting up there and people downloading or streaming it. So we decided to look at other opportunities, and we really were interested because we were both big readers, and my wife, who's a partner with me in founding the publishing company, is a writer, published author, columnist for Ms. Magazine, et cetera. She's been writing all of her life, and we said, let's do publishing. So we did, and we started with a very modest little book and have been adding ever since. This is our fifth year.
Nice.
And we took the name Rootstock from Rootstock Recordings, which was one of our record labels. So.
And why Rootstock? What does that signify to you?
So when we began to look at the music we were putting out, performance artists and roots music from all over the world music, we tried to find a word that would encompass that. Obviously, world music, earth music, all of those things were taken. So my wife, who is quite the green thumb, came up with Rootstock, and it just seems to work. We're talking about the roots of ideas and expressing those ideas in creative ways. And music, obviously, was one way, and now books are certainly another.
Oh, brilliant. So a bit of a hybrid there. Now, Samantha, I mentioned the term hybrid publishing in the introduction. What is that? What is hybrid publishing?
So that's a good question, and it's something that's gaining a little more popularity. I would say it's between a traditional publisher and a self-publishing venture. Basically, we offer a full-service experience for an author who's looking to publish their book. And by full-service, I mean we help provide book design, book editing, book proofreading, the printing, distribution, and marketing. So it's really quite a full service. If you just do self-publishing, you're going to have to do all those things on your own. And the cost to hire book editors and book designers and even publicists to do the marketing and the press releases and everything that goes with promoting a book is going to be quite costly. So when you go with a hybrid publisher, you can, you know, use the funds that you would do for self-publishing and get a full-service place where you get, with Rootstock, you get nationwide, actually global distribution now. And so it's really quite a good, I'd say it's a good avenue for people who are looking to do their book in a more hands-on way, because as the author will retain 100% of the copyright. We will work with them every step of the way in the book design and everything so that they really get the book that they want.
Stephen, I want to mention that the first of your books that I read, and I've counted four that I know of rootstock books, so I'm probably pretty high up on just an average consumer. The first of your books that I read was Rick Winston's Red Scare in the Green Mountains, which I absolutely love. So tell us a little bit about that book and why going through rootstock was the way to go for Rick Winston.
So, in your introduction, you talked about authors needing an agent and about how difficult it is to get an agent to go with any of the large presses. And that holds true in some ways with some of the more the second tier of independent presses, not the majors, but the second tier of larger independent presses. Even though you can submit directly to them, they also like the agents. It's extremely difficult to get there. Mm-hmm. And we have authors who come to us who have been rejected many times or who have just decided that path is too onerous for them. It just is too much work, too long of a process, and often results in constant pink slips. So, we decided that we would focus, and we did focus primarily on Vermont authors. And when we first got going, lo and behold, Rick Winston, whom I've known for many years, mm-hmm. Came to us with this really fascinating book. And he decided that we were the people to do it. Obviously, one of the main markets is Vermont, and we focused on that. We also focused on other markets in New England and history buffs, but it just was one of these wonderful synchronicities of his wonderful history and our initial publishing. So,
and give people just a little taste of what that book was about.
So between the years 1946 and 1960, which really represents the McCarthy years in some ways nationally, mm-hmm. We in Vermont had a number of very, very interesting stories, and they're all detailed in Rick's book, involving McCarthyite influences here in Vermont. People who were radicals in some ways politically, becoming oppressed and repressed as a result of that. And he tells these marvelous stories of how people dealt with it, how the press and media dealt with it. And it's just a really exciting, revealing book about that era in Vermont. And a relatively unknown history part of Vermont.
Absolutely. Stephen, Rootstock belongs to a number of independent book publishing groups, and you're on the board of Independent Publishers of New England. In publishing terms, what does that mean, independent? What does that encompass?
Well, independent can be anything from a larger press, independent press, like Chelsea Green, for instance. Mm-hmm. Here in Vermont, they have hundreds of books. She Writes Press, which is another hybrid press, much larger than us. They put out about 500 or 600 books out on the West Coast. Wow. And then even smaller presses where an author, for instance, publishes all of their books through their own publishing company. As a result, they have a publishing company, and they find benefit from joining the Independent Book Publishers Association, the national, or the regional ones, like the Independent Publishers of New England. So,
Now, Samantha, I know poetry is really your area, but first of all, does Rootstock consider all genres?
We do. We do fiction, nonfiction, young adult. We do picture books, but only when it has an arts component. It's either about the performing arts or the visual arts. That's our niche with children's publishing. But we mostly stick to adult genres. We have mystery thrillers. We have history books like Rick Winston's book. We also have a self-help inspirational book called Preaching Happiness. So we do consider all genres. And poetry is about a year old now. I came on about it, well, maybe it was 2 years ago.
Time flies, especially in a pandemic year. Well, how many books of poetry have you published so far?
We have four. We have a couple in the hopper that we're considering now. So we did three in 2020 and one for 2021 so far. And two of those authors are Vermont authors. One other poet is from Miami, and then we have another poet from Washington State.
Wow. So the authors that you're drawing from, I mean, obviously you get a lot from Vermont, but where else, how are people finding out and why are they coming to Rootstock, Samantha? Tell me about that picture, that kind of national global picture that you seem to have already.
Sure. That's a great question. So we put ourselves on a platform called Submittable. And writers and people in the writing world will know what that means if they've been submitting work to small presses or to journals. So it's a platform where any writer can go in and submit their work to be considered for publication. And any publisher, whether it's a literary journal, a magazine, or a small press like Rootstock, any publisher can go on Submittable and put an open call for submissions. So we went on there, I guess it was 2 years ago when I started, and we put our calls for manuscripts, looking for poetry, fiction, nonfiction. And so that's when we really started getting submissions from all over the country. Prior to that, as Stephen said, when he first opened, he was focusing on Vermont books. And, you know, we still focus on Vermont books. We love Vermont authors because, you know, we're based here right out of Montpelier, Vermont. We have great connections with our local bookstores, with all the readers in the area. So it is really nice for us to do Vermont books. But we're also branched out to be able to do national books through, you know, getting those submissions from all over. And really what we look for in a manuscript is the quality of the writing. So an author doesn't have to be from Vermont, or an author doesn't have to be from anywhere, really. The author's work has to be superb for us to publish it.
I was just going to mention that in furthering some of the things that Samantha said, we have a book coming up which is entitled Collecting Courage. It was originally published late last year in Canada, and it is a collection of stories from 14 black women and one black man from Canada and the United States about anti-black racism in the charitable sector in both the U.S. and Canada. It is an extraordinary book. These authors are from all over Canada and the United States. It's probably the first book we're doing that has such a huge geographic collection of voices and stories about such an issue.
I can definitely am excited about that. It's called Collecting Courage, you said?
Collecting Courage.
Beautiful.
We'll certainly make sure that everybody who wants to know about the book, and I'm sure we're hoping that nationally it's going to get some real recognition because it deserves that kind of recognition.
It's on our website now.
I know. I saw it. I thought it was already published, but that's exciting. When is that coming out?
We're hoping September.
All right. Excellent. That sounds great. Well, Stephen, what is the hardest part for an author, to get a book out?
Well, if an author wants to do all of the things that we think are important to publish a book, the whole process is not easy. I'm not sure exactly who it was, but an author, maybe it was Ernest Hemingway, said, you sit down in front of your typewriter, of course, back then, and you bleed. and then the process after that is you have to have an editor. And then the pain that goes along with really having an editor look closely at your work, and then a proofreader, and then figuring out how to quote, package the book. What's the title? What's the subtitle? What's the cover going to be? What kind of cover art? All of these are really difficult decisions for the serious author, for authors who are essentially giving birth to this work of theirs, this manuscript. So it's a tough road to hoe, and that would hold true if you were doing it with a major press or with a hybrid press or an independent traditional press. If you just have a manuscript and you put it up on a website and you say, here's my book, that's fairly easy. But we think that's the wrong way to go for serious authors.
Mm-hmm. Samantha, I want to go ahead. Go right ahead.
So I was going to say, and you know what Stephen says about what we think needs to happen to make a book, we have a proven track record of having books that have won many independent press awards. So we really do know what makes an award-winning book when it comes in terms of the cover art, like Stephen said, the title. We've had manuscripts come to us with different titles than when they, you know, by the time they publish, we've changed the title. And then it really does help the whole package when you think of the book. It's not only the art that you're putting into the world, it's the message you're putting into the world. And there is a marketing component to what you put out into the world, which is what we help take care of. And like I said, they've won awards with the independent, it's called the IPBE Awards, the Independent Book Publishers Association Awards. We've also had Scudder Parker. He published his debut book of poetry with us, and his book, Safe as Lightning, won the Independent Publishers of New England Best Poetry Award and the Best Book of the Year Award. So that would be quite exciting.
Well done, Scudder. I want to shoot up another flare on one of your books. I had the author on a few months back, Samantha, and that would be Sam Clark, The Inland Sea. Tell us about that book and the journey for Sam Clark.
That was quite a journey. As everyone knows, he's a cabinet maker and a builder, and he builds beautiful cabinets and furniture. And he also built a world with words. It's an interesting journey. But when you think about it, you know, creativity comes out in many forms. He is a boater, and he loves being on the lake. So he constructed a story around the Inland Sea, which is a part of Lake Champlain. And he made a murder mystery. It's completely fabricated, but he did a lot of research with the local state police and with detectives to really learn the procedural, right? Because when you have a crime kind of murder mystery book, you have to make sure everything is authentic and correct to give the reader a good experience. And that was a beautiful journey. We love the cover art. I'm forgetting who did that cover art, though, and I think Stephen can probably say who did that one for the Inland Sea.
I think that is a Susan Bull Riley painting.
Oh, beautiful. That makes sense. Yeah, so it's a local Vermont artwork on the cover.
Sam actually worked on her house and did some amazing work with her.
Oh,
so,
my.
I don't want to say the wrong person.
All right. Well, we'll try to find that before the end of the show if we can. really outstanding book. Really enjoyed it. And I had no idea that the Inland Sea was a thing in Lake Champlain. I learned a lot about the geography of Lake Champlain while getting to live in the islands for a few weeks as I read the book. It just took me there every time I opened that book, which was really great. Stephen, what level of gatekeeping is there at Rootstock? Do you turn books down? Do you always offer to publish if an author engages your services? How does that go?
We're known as a curated press. And when Samantha said that we value the quality of the manuscript, that's absolutely a prerequisite for us in terms of what we publish. We're very lucky. I mean, we do turn manuscripts down, obviously, and we get some writing that just doesn't meet our standards. However, we have been very lucky in the quality of the books that have been submitted to us. I think what Sam was talking about, the awards that we've won are pretty much reflective of the kind of quality of a manuscript, the quality of the writing that we want. If we don't put out readable, exciting, engaging books, it doesn't do us any good, much less the author. So we that partnership word that we use when we talk about what we do is really important. So, yes, we are a curated press.
Mm-hmm. And Samantha,
and I think it's good for the author. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go right ahead.
Well, I was going to say, when an author approaches us with a manuscript, we like them to have an open mind to consider these kinds of things as far as working with us to choose a cover art or even, like I said, change the title or editing to get the manuscript as good as it can be. My dog is growling. So really, it's, we're not looking for an author to come to us and say, here's the book, you have to publish it as is, because that's not how we work. We are going to have a process to make the book as best, as good as it can be, and every book needs an editor. Every author, even Stephen King, needs an editor.
Yeah.
I have actually had meetings with authors who have expressed shock when I say the first thing that happens is that your manuscript goes to an editor. And, it's like, an editor? Oh, no, I don't want anything that might have changed. Well,
thank goodness for editors. Yeah. We only have about a minute left, Stephen. I do want to ask, do you also produce audio versions of books and e-books? Are those things that Rootstock does as well?
Not yet, but we're looking at that very closely.
Well, we do the e-books, but not the audio.
You do?
We do e-books, yes, but not. Yes.
Excellent. All right. And, go ahead.
All of our books are available through all of the online kinds of retailers around the world, literally everybody, Kobo, Amazon, Apple Books, you name it. So they're all there, but they're also available through your local bookstores.
Absolutely.
And that's the important thing for us. We're very much a supporter of independent bookstores.
All right. Now, I am going to mention the last two books. I mentioned four that I read of yours. Mm-hmm. The other two, A Dream to Die For by Susan Ritz, and Have a Hammer, Building Grant Proposals for Social Change by Barbara Florsch. Those are the two others that I've read. I want to thank you both, Samantha Culber and Stephen MacArthur from Rootstock Publishing, for being on with us this morning.
Thanks for having us.
All right, take care. We're going to break for CBS News, then return to hear your thoughts with a half hour of Open Phones. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th, time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
All right, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. It's Open Phones time, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. At the top of the show, we heard from a person who might have inspired the lyrics for two Grateful Dead songs and one Dylan tune. Any close encounters of the celebrity kind for you? I'll tell you how I almost starred in a movie with John Travolta. We'll get to that, almost. But that might be a bit of a stretch. I'll let you decide as we get to that later. What's on your mind? What are you seeing from our beloved Sox or whoever you support in baseball? They open up a series tonight against Detroit. And they played 3-4 in Texas against the lowly Rangers. And Rangers took 3-4. But that was on the road. Now we're back home. should handle the Tigers. Anything in the State House that might have your interest? Did you get out in your town on Green Up Day and clean up? I'd love to hear anyone who took that on. If you're a small business looking for help, we're hearing a lot that having trouble finding help, you can let us know. If you want to sell something on the Trading Post, you know I always open it up. I won't even read the rules to you now. Our number is 244-1777, 877-291-8255. We are open for business until, what, 11 o'clock, right? Yeah, 11 o'clock. All right, so yesterday, let's take a look here. Oh, let me clean up this one. We were talking with the folks from Rootstock Publishing in Montpelier, and I brought up Inland Sea by Sam Clark, and a really beautiful artwork on the cover. And we just want to confirm they thought it was this artist, and it was indeed. Susan Bull Riley did the cover work on Inland Sea, so wanted to confirm that. And really neat book, Sam Clark's Inland Sea. This is a guy who has written some nonfiction books about woodworking and takes a hack at a murder mystery novel and does pretty well. I think Archer Mayer would give him a thumbs up for his work on that. All right, who do we got? We have Fred calling. How are you doing, Fred?
Good. How about yourself?
Fabuloso.
That's good. Hey, look, you know, this go big business with the president, with all the spending he's doing, it looks like there's a good possibility that prices are going to go up. If you look at commodities, mm-hmm. all the food commodities, wheat, flour, that sort of thing, if you look at copper, if you look at, let's see, lumber. Lumber's another big one that's going up.
Yeah.
So what apparently is going to happen is...
Now some of those are pushed by the demand by the fact that, you know, factories, et cetera, were shut down. So not all that is pushed by more money in the economy. But go ahead, Fred. I understand what you're saying.
There is a ton of money in the economy, right?
That's right.
Yeah, okay. So what's going to happen, I think, is inflation is going to go up, mm-hmm. and it seems as if that it takes quite a while for the wages to catch up with inflation.
Right.
So that means that inflation is going to be here longer than I think we should have it. And it's going to hurt more older people, particularly retired people that are on fixed incomes.
Right.
So they're going to really be paying the big price. And I think that's sort of going to be a tragedy, because if you look at the demographics of the country now, we're not exactly a spring chicken country.
Yeah, we certainly are aging out. Vermont definitely getting grayer. Although, you know, during the pandemic, we've seen younger families moving up here to be, you know, because of the safety of it. And it's an excellent point. And, you know, if you and I were president and vice president, you could be president. I'll be your VP. You know, you want to stimulate the economy, right, Fred? You want to do whatever you can in a situation like this, just like 07, just like after 9/11. And you use the power of the government, you use the ability to, get money into the hands of the electorate, and because jobs went away, so you want to push it. How far is too far, right? Go ahead.
That's an interesting question.
Yeah.
But, I could speak for myself. I was born in 1943,
mm-hmm.
and I never thought going downhill was going to be so difficult.
Yeah. All right. I'll take that. All right. Good questions. I don't know when you ease up. I mean, we know there's a lot of infrastructure projects that have been put on hold that we never seem to have money for. Think here in our schools in Vermont, right? There are capital projects that need to be done, but there's never enough money for it. Under the guise maybe, or needing the impetus during this pandemic, money is now available for these projects, and things will get done in schools that should have been done 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago, maybe. I'm sure someone who's sitting on a school board could call in and give me an example. But where is that money going to come from? How are you going to get whatever it might be, $50,000, $100,000? And these capital projects are expensive. They balloon to $1 million without any real work that needs to be done. They can go that high. They're never going to get done. Now's a time where you can put money into it. But as Fred says, you know, when do you take your foot off the gas? Because keeping it down to the floor definitely will cause inflation, and it will hurt those whose income remains static at this point. So, Fred, good point. Fred's also the one who brought up yesterday about District of Columbia. There's plenty of talk in Washington right now about making it the 51st state. A lot of hurdles to get passed, and probably will not happen, but we floated the idea of the 51-star flag, and I put it on Fred, but he didn't want to do that. So we had two listeners who did take on the challenge, and one was Rich in Starksboro, and the other was Will, and the two of them came up with ideas, and what's interesting is they both used different aspects of the current field of stars on our 50-star flag. Now, Rich, what he used was the fact that the current field alternates between, I think it's 6 and 7 stars on each line. So just a difference of stars between each line. He went 6 rows deep and did 9, then 8, then 9, then 8, then 9, then 8. So that came up with 51. He actually did nail it. Now, Will, he went the other way. Right now we have 9 rows of stars in that field of blue. And so he kept the 9 rows, but then he had to alternate 7 and 4, 7 at the top, 7 at the bottom. And that brought him to 51. And sure enough, we have two Betsy Rosses in our midst who have redesigned the flag to incorporate the District of Columbia should that happen. Rich in Starksboro, Will, the two of them are ahead of the game. And if we go to 51, we'll make sure we submit that to our congressional delegation and let them know that we've got two flag makers here who are well ahead of it. All right, what else we got? I want to let you know there will be no equal time with Travin this afternoon. Taking the day off, that was normally 1 to 2. So the flip side means you get 3 full hours of Greg Hooker and the Getaway. He does such a great job with that music. So you can tune in today at 1, go 1 to 4 with Greg Hooker. And, of course, he loves to hear from you. You can make any kind of a request that fits in with that show. 244-1777 is our number, 877-291-8255. Those are the numbers to call if you want to jump on the line. Join me on open phones here. And we're going to get one in here, or do we go to a break? Let's see what we go. I think we got Rich in Starksboro. Let's go to Rich.
Hi, I was told we were going to go to break, but I guess
we'll go to you first. Break. You're the man. Okay. You're on.
All right. I got a question about the vaccine. I've had this question about 3 months or so, and okay. Of course I don't know how to get those people that ask the governor questions to ask them this question. But if I could, I would have done this a long time ago. But
right.
I'll just put it out to you, and maybe you know the channels. But my question has to do with the emergency status of the vaccine. In the U.S., we've got over 100 million people who are fully vaccinated. And I was wondering if the FDA has any kind of policies where they can consider that a trial, and just say, well, this thing's working. Why don't we just take the emergency status off and let her go? And in that way, we can be more, I guess, lack of a better word, more forceful about requiring people to take the vaccine. Because Dr. Levine says, well, because it's an emergency status vaccine, we can't force people to get vaccinated.
Oh, Rich, this is such a great question. I wish you had called this in on Friday when I had Lindsay Leininger on from Dear Pandemic. She might have had an answer for us on this. It's an excellent question, Rich. We have probably the biggest trial going on because this is still an emergency status. It has not been approved. It had to be rushed, right? And I don't know how long an actual trial needs to take and, you know, how closely we would need to be monitored. But it's a fantastic question. It might be your best question ever, Rich.
Really? Wow.
Do not know the answer. So maybe we'll try to find that for you.
You can't get a much bigger trial than what we got going on right now.
That's the absolute truth. All right, we are going to take a break now. Bye-bye. Thank you. All right, Rich from Starksboro, flag designer and excellent question asker. All right, Stephen, we're coming to you in Montpelier. How you doing?
Hi. I just want to mention that today is a very important person in Montpelier's birthday. Ann Sarka, I believe, is 92, and she has done so much for Montpelier. She's been on the Conservation Commission. She's a member of the Unitarian Church. And she's also been very active with mental health through the Spring Lake Ranch in Cuttingsville.
All right.
And so she's a very special person. And she was a student of Carmelita Hinton at the Putney School many years ago. Mm-hmm. And she's just a wonderful person. So I wanted to let everybody know it's her birthday. And I think she wishes a special shout out.
All right. 92, you said?
I believe so.
All right. I hope you're not over. It's better if you get under when you shout out somebody's birthday.
It's about right. Okay. That's my calculation.
All right, Stephen. I think she'll probably let it slide. I think, once you hit 90, whatever the age you put on me, it's all the same. Hey, thanks for that, Stephen. Ann Sarka, I have never met her. I hope I have the opportunity. Happy birthday, Ann, and thanks for all you've done for this state. And Stephen, thanks for letting us know about that. All right, what else do I have? I'm running out of stuff here, so I need a caller, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And you can suggest topics. You can sell something on the Trading Post. You can, what else? Tell us about the vaccine. Oh, I've got that story I've got to tell. So we heard earlier this morning from John, who says he's co-written, really, three songs, two for the Grateful Dead, one for Bob Dylan, Silvio for Dylan, Touch of Grey, and Run for the Roses for the Dead. And I said, if you have any kind of a near celebrity encounter, close encounters of the celebrity kind, you can share that. And I said I almost starred in a movie with John Travolta. All right. It was the movie was called Blowout, and I'm going to say that most people don't remember it, but those who do, it was actually a pretty wonderful movie. And they filmed it in, 81. Yep, 1981 in Philly. And I was the mascot of my college, the first mascot at the University of Dayton. And so we were on a road trip with the basketball team to Philly to play LaSalle at the Palestra, which still hosts basketball. It's a great basketball shrine there, a temple of hoops. And afterwards, a friend of mine and I, as a matter of fact, my friend Craig, who turned 60 this very day, we went to pick up some liquid refreshment, and we were down near Penn's Landing in Philly, and it was late, almost midnight, probably somewhere between 11 and midnight. And Penn's Landing, which at that time of night would be just dark, would be nothing going on there, had lights everywhere, cranes with big banks of lights, and And so we drove over, we parked, and we go walking up, and there's a building there with like a cafeteria. It is packed with people at near midnight, and we go walking, and I would say we were probably within about 100 yards of all the action, as it turned out, a movie set. And a car rolls up next to us with four security guards in, and they roll down the window. And one of them says to us, where are you guys going? We said, we're just going over here to see what they're doing. And he said, well, they're filming a movie, and they don't want you in it. And that's how close I came to starring with John Travolta in Blowout back in 1981. So that was how close I came. I didn't come close to co-writing any songs with the Dead or with Bob Dylan, but I did come that close to starring in Blowout with John Travolta. It was actually a pretty excellent film, kind of a thrilling and murder mystery, if I remember correctly. Really had it on edge of your seat. So, all right, who do we got next? We got Steve. Let's take a call from Steve in Stowe. Steve in Stowe. Hey, Steve.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got a quick little story. I'm a chef, and I was working at one of the hotels in Stowe.
Yeah.
In the early 90s, before Spruce Peak was Spruce Peak, and they were doing concerts up there.
Uh-huh.
And every morning I had to make carrot juice for Meatloaf. You know, the singer dude?
Yeah.
And you know how many carrots it takes to make juice? A lot.
No idea.
I'm telling you what. Every morning he had to have the carrot juice. Well, he gave me tickets to his concert right up close to the stage. And after the concert, he sat and talked with us when everybody else skedaddled out. You know, they just left the concert.
Yeah.
And he stayed right there and he talked to us. And that was the coolest thing ever happened in my life.
Oh, I bet. I was a big fan going back to Rocky Horror Picture Show. And then Bat Out of Hell. His producer, it was a guy named Jim Steinman, who I don't know if you remember any of this, Steve, but yeah, he was so great. But Steinman had a whole album for Meatloaf that Meatloaf didn't do, so Steinman did the material, and that's a great album too. But how much fun to hang with Meatloaf and make his carrot juice. Oh, turn your radio down, Steve.
All right, who do we got next?
Oh, well. All right. Thanks, Steve. All right. Well, that is a great close encounter, probably better than mine because I didn't actually even see – I didn't even get to see John Travolta. But Stephen Stowe, a chef, and made the carrot juice every morning for Meatloaf, then got to hang with him, see the concert, and, boy, that's a great story. All right. We're going to have more of those next time we do open phones, which will probably be tomorrow morning. But I think we're going to have – we definitely have – Congressman Peter Welch, 10:30 to 11, and then we'll have Randy Brock somewhere in the 9 o'clock hour. He's got really great thoughts to talk about the rollout of broadband, and we'd love to hear that for them. Okay, that's it, Danny. Stick a cork in it. We've had enough. That's our show for today. Yeah, yeah, he just did that. Okay, Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro. It's directed by Danny McGivergan. Let you know our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. So please keep those ideas coming. Guests, topics, we love to hear them. To listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint, you can download it, our podcast at wdevradio.com. A lot of other fun stuff there. And we got the Governor's COVID-19 Response News Conference coming up after CBS News. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.